Good morning and welcome to Simply Space. It's Tuesday, April 23rd. On today's show, we explore how lunar regolith is transforming habitat design and NASA prepares for a spacewalk outside the International Space Station. Plus, South Korea unveils plans for a massive 120 gigawatt space solar project. This coverage and more, up next. I'm David, and you're listening to Simply Space. I apologize for the confusion, but it appears that the closing sentence provided is incomplete. Could you please provide the full closing sentence so that I can generate a proper transition to the opening sentence about the quantitative evaluation of techniques for solidifying and shaping lunar soil? I'd be happy to assist once I have the complete information.
Absolutely, David. To date, researchers have come up with nearly 20 different techniques that fall into four main categories based on the mechanisms used to bond the regolith particles together. 1. Reaction solidification, where compounds are added to the regolith to chemically bond the particles. This typically uses 60 to 95% local regolith. 2. Sintering and melting, which involves heating the regolith to very high temperatures, often using 100% local material. However, the 1,000 plus Celsius temperatures required can be challenging. 3. Bonding solidification that uses adhesive binders to stick the particles together. The local regolith ratio is usually 65 to 95%. 4. Confinement formation, where the loose regolith is contained in a fabric bag. This uses up to 99% local regolith and has low temperature and time requirements. The components have tensile strength but may lack in compression. So in summary, there are a variety of PROM methods that utilize the lunar soil in different ways to create construction materials.
Very interesting. So with all these different techniques, how do the scientists determine which ones are the most promising for actual use in lunar construction?
Great question. The researchers introduced a quantitative evaluation framework called 8IMM that looks at 8 key indicators important for construction needs. This includes things like minimizing the material that needs to be transported from Earth, the energy requirements, the complexity of the process, and the reliability in the lunar environment. Based on this analysis, a technique called regolith bagging scored the highest. This is the confinement method I mentioned that places the loose regolith in a fabric bag. It has low material and energy needs and allows large components to be made rapidly, so it's very promising for large-scale construction. The sintering and melting techniques also ranked consistently high. Casting methods produce components with exceptional strength, so those could be used for critical parts. And techniques that use solar energy for melting are great for low energy needs. So scientists can use this type of quantitative evaluation to identify the most appropriate techniques for different construction applications.
It sounds like a lot of thought is going into how to sustainably build on the moon for the long term. What is the overall plan and timeline that researchers have laid out for establishing this lunar infrastructure?
Scientists have put together a comprehensive four-stage plan in line with the goals of the International Lunar Research Stations. Stage 1 is the laboratory stage to support unmanned research. Stage 2 is the research station to allow astronauts to conduct temporary science missions. Stage 3 is the residence stage that will meet all the living and working needs of lunar astronauts, similar to the International Space Station. And finally, Stage 4 is the habitat stage, envisioned as a self-sustaining human settlement and a base for launching deep space missions. For the construction itself, the researchers proposed using that regolith bag technology I mentioned as a practical solution based on its high scores in their evaluation framework. So that's the plan, to gradually build up the infrastructure in stages to eventually allow permanent human habitation on the moon.
Fascinating stuff. It's amazing to think that the dirt on the moon may hold the key to building our future there. Thanks, Michael, for that report. Shifting our focus a bit closer to home, NASA is gearing up for a spacewalk outside the International Space Station on April 25th. 2 Russian cosmonauts will venture out to install equipment and conduct experiments. For more details, we turn to our space correspondent. So what exactly will the cosmonauts be doing during this spacewalk?
The two Roscosmos cosmonauts, Oleg Kononenko and Nikolai Chub, have a busy day planned. Their primary objective is to finish deploying a panel on a synthetic radar system located on the station's Nauka module. This radar system is an important piece of technology for the ISS.
And I understand they have some other tasks planned as well, beyond just the radar panel deployment.
That's right. Kononenko and Chub will also be installing equipment and experiments on the station's Poisk module. The goal is to analyze the level of corrosion present on various station surfaces and modules. Corrosion is an ever-present concern for the aging space station, which has now been continuously occupied for over 20 years. Monitoring the extent of corrosion helps engineers on the ground assess the health and longevity of the ISS structure.
This will be a lengthy excursion for the cosmonauts, correct? How much spacewalking experience do they have between them?
The spacewalk could last up to 7 hours, so it will indeed be an extended outing. However, both cosmonauts are veterans at this. For Oleg Kononenko, this will be his 7th career spacewalk. Nikolai Chub is a bit less experienced but has one previous spacewalk under his belt already, so the two should be well prepared for the long day ahead of them.
And for those interested in watching the action live, NASA will be providing coverage.
Yes, NASA TV will have live coverage beginning at 10:30 a.m. Eastern Time on Thursday, April 25th. The actual spacewalk is slated to begin at 10:55 a.m. Viewers can follow along as the cosmonauts exit through the Poisk airlock and make their way to the worksite. It should provide a fascinating glimpse at what it takes to maintain an orbiting outpost like the ISS.
It's amazing to think about the level of coordination required between the international partners to keep the space station running smoothly.
Absolutely. Even though geopolitical tensions on Earth are high between Russia and the West right now, the space station remains one area where cooperation continues between NASA, Roscosmos, and the other partner agencies. Joint spacewalks like this one demonstrate how the ISS program has endured as a symbol of peaceful collaboration in space, despite conflicts on the ground.
It will be interesting to see what the cosmonauts discover in terms of corrosion on the station's exterior. The harsh environment of space certainly takes its toll over time.
The cosmonauts will be paying especially close attention to any signs of corrosion around the Poisk module, which is one of the older components of the ISS, having launched back in 2009. Poisk serves as an airlock and docking port for visiting Soyuz spacecraft. Ensuring its structural integrity is critical. The samples and data Kononenko and Chub collect during the spacewalk will give engineers valuable information to help extend the lifespan of the ISS, which is currently approved to operate through at least 2030.
We'll certainly be watching on Thursday to see how the spacewalk unfolds. Thank you for the preview and for putting this excursion into a broader context. Speaking of space-related developments, South Korea is making strides in the development of space-based solar power. Scientists from the Korea Aerospace Research Institute and the Korea Electrotechnology Research Institute recently presented advancements in their Korean Space Solar Power Satellite Project, also known as KSSPS. For more on this, we turn to our correspondent. So what exactly did these Korean researchers unveil?
The researchers presented a conceptual design of the satellite they are developing, as well as an end-of-life disposal method for when the satellite is no longer in use. They also shared details on a first pilot system and experiment. While still in the early stages, this provides a glimpse into South Korea's vision for space-based solar power.
How does South Korea's progress compare to other countries pursuing similar technologies?
Japan has set a goal to develop gigawatt-level space solar power satellites by 2050. China is aiming for megawatt-level satellites by 2035 and gigawatt-level by 2050. While South Korea entered this field relatively late compared to those countries, the researchers note that Korea has still made notable progress and is demonstrating its commitment to achieving space-based solar power.
What are some of the key specifications of the satellite design that the Korean researchers proposed?
The researchers emphasize that the design is conceptual at this stage and not derived from rigorous analysis. However, it provides a sense of the system requirements they are targeting for commercial viability. The proposed satellite would have a mass of 10,000 tons. It would transmit microwaves at a frequency of 5.8 gigahertz to Earth using a 1 square kilometer antenna.
And how would that microwave energy be captured and converted into usable electricity on the ground?
Special receiving antennas, called rectennas, would be used on the ground to receive the microwave energy transmitted from the satellite. Rectennas are designed to convert that electromagnetic energy into direct current electricity that could then be fed into the power grid. So it's a way to wirelessly transmit solar energy captured in space down to Earth.
It's a fascinating concept. What would be some of the advantages of generating solar power in space compared to Earth-based solar?
Solar panels in space can receive sunlight continuously without any interference from the day-night cycle, weather, or seasons that affect solar installations on Earth. The sunlight is also more intense above the Earth's atmosphere. So, space-based solar could potentially provide an abundant and steady source of renewable energy. However, the technology is still very early in development and faces challenges in terms of cost and the logistics of assembling and maintaining large structures in orbit.
It will certainly be interesting to follow the progress in the years ahead, both in South Korea and other nations pursuing this technology. Thank you for the insight. Speaking of space exploration, NASA's Voyager 1 spacecraft, the most distant human-made object in the cosmos, has been experiencing communication issues for the past 5 months. But now, after some clever troubleshooting by NASA engineers, the probe is sending back decipherable data once again. Here with more details is our Simply Space correspondent. So what exactly was the issue with Voyager 1's communication system?
Well, David, the problem started back in November when Voyager 1's flight data system began sending an indecipherable repeating pattern of code. This system is responsible for collecting information from the spacecraft's science instruments and bundling it with engineering data that reflects Voyager 1's current health status. Normally, Mission Control receives this data in binary code, a series of ones and zeros. But for the past few months, the data has been stuck in an unreadable loop, even though Voyager 1 continued sending a steady radio signal.
That must have been concerning for the mission team, considering Voyager 1 is about 15 billion miles away from Earth. How did they go about fixing this issue?
The team got creative and sent various commands to try restarting the spacecraft's computer system and diagnose the underlying problem. On March 1st, they sent what's called a poke command to get the flight data system to run different software sequences, hoping to pinpoint the cause of the glitch. A couple days later, they noticed unusual activity from one part of the system that stood out from the garbled data. An engineer with NASA's Deep Space Network, which helps the agency communicate with distant spacecraft, was able to decode this signal. Remarkably, it contained a readout of the entire flight data system's memory.
Fascinating that they were able to extract that information from billions of miles away. So what did this decoded memory readout reveal?
By carefully analyzing the memory readout, engineers traced the issue to a single component, the telemetry modulation unit. This is the part of the flight data system that was sending the repeating pattern and disrupting the probe's communication. With this knowledge, the team crafted a new set of commands on April 20th to essentially bypass the malfunctioning unit. To their delight, Voyager 1 began sending back its first coherent engineering data in 5 months.
That's an incredible feat of long-distance troubleshooting. What does this restored communication mean for the Voyager 1 mission going forward?
While the team is still reviewing all the new data, the initial signs suggest that Voyager 1 is healthy and operating properly. Regaining this communication link is crucial for monitoring the spacecraft's status and relaying any science data it collects. At 46 years old and 15 billion miles from home, Voyager 1 has certainly shown its age in recent years. But this triumph highlights both the probe's resilience and the ingenuity of the engineers guiding its epic journey. As project scientist Linda Spilker said, "We're back in communication with the spacecraft, and we look forward to getting science data back." An inspiring reminder of how human curiosity and problem solving can reach across the vastness of space.
A remarkable story of perseverance, both human and robotic. Thanks for that enlightening report. And with that, we wrap up our stories for today. Thanks for listening to Simply Space. We'll see you back here tomorrow.